I'm Ingrid Christiansen, and this is a session on a woman's place, as a woman's place is communicated to us through imagery, and particularly through imagery given to us by our society. But I'm going to use the words of lots of wise women so that I don't have to try to conjure up some wisdom myself. Fortunately, there's lots of stuff out there. So I'm going to attempt to get at a phenomena that I notice a lot in society, in myself, in other women. I think it's a problem that women have probably more than men. And I use this kind of analysis that I'm going to be talking about to help me deal with ways in which I am limited by my environment. And also, when I'm thinking about questions of racism, I find this is helpful for me. We all know what a woman's place is. The phrases abound in our society about a woman's place. It's in the home. Or a woman's place is in the House and in the Senate. You've seen the bumper sticker. A woman's place is as a sex object. We're supposed to be beautiful, for men in particular, so that even our life-sustaining breasts, which are given to us to feed babies with, without which babies would have died until the invention of the bottle, is not to sustain the race. It's to please men. A woman's place is as a teacher, a nurse, or a secretary. I've heard that twice this week in the dining room over in conversation. You know, I knew my place. I knew that I could be a teacher, a nurse, or a secretary. So we know the images, and I'm not subscribing to one set of images. I think that each of us has sort of learned a different line, a different tape, a different set of images that applies to us. But in general, you know the kinds of things that it's okay for women to do in our society, and you know the kinds of things that are shocking or off-putting, or she is thought to be harsh and aggressive when he's a leader. You know, the kind of distinction that operates there. So what I think I've discovered over the years is that I am weakened by some parts of my environment and strengthened by others. And I have noticed it in other people. I'll see a friend of mine leading a meeting very competently, a woman, and somebody will walk in the room that I know she has trouble with and I know doesn't think well of her, a man, and she'll fall apart. She'll stop leading the meeting, essentially, be dissolved, really, by that. And I hate it when that happens in me. I just hate it. And so I've been thinking about how to fight it, because it does happen to me, and it happens to most of us, I think. So this is partly sharing strategy with you on how I fight that phenomenon, because I hate it so much. I hate it when I'm doing perfectly well until the wrong person comes in the door. So I'm going to talk about that some. And as I said, I do think it helps me think about my own racism and deal with it and make progress struggling on that issue. It's a problem of perceptions, our perception of ourself, which is internalized, whatever, internalized sexism or internalized, you know, I believe what the person who thinks poorly of me says about me, or the perception by others of us, which challenges our performance and our progress in the world so much so that we are often rendered incompetent. To explain what kind of women I'm talking about, let me read you a poem by called Wonder Women, by a woman called Jenny Lynn. Sometimes I see reflections on bits of glass on sidewalks. I catch the glimmer of empty bottles floating out to sea. Sometimes I stretch my arms way above my head and wonder if there are women along the Mekong doing the same. Sometimes I stare longingly at women who I will never know. Generous, laughing women with wrinkled cheeks and white teeth, dragging along chubby, rosy-cheeked babies on fat, wobbly legs. Sometimes I stare at Chinese grandmothers getting on the 30 Stockton with shopping bags, Japanese women tourists in European hats, middle-aged mothers with laundry carts, young wives holding hands with their husbands, lesbian women holding hands in coffee houses, smiling debutantes with bouquets of yellow daffodils, silver-haired matrons with silver rhinestoned poodles, painted prostitutes posing along MacArthur Boulevard, giddy teenage girls snapping gum in fast cars, widows clutching Bibles, crucifixes. I look at them and wonder if they are a part of me. I look in their eyes and wonder if they share my dreams. I wonder if the woman in mink is content, if the stockbroker's wife is afraid of growing old, if the professor's wife is an alcoholic, if the woman in prison is me. There are copper-tanned women in Hyannisport playing tennis, women who eat with finger bowls. There are women in factories punching time clocks, women tired every waking hour of the day. I wonder why there are women born with silver spoons in their mouths, women who have never known a day of hunger, women who have never changed their own bed linen. And I wonder why there are women who must work, women who must clean other women's houses, women who must sell shrimps for pennies a day, women who must sew other women's clothes, who must cook, who must die in childbirth or in dreams. Why must women stand divided, building the walls that tear them down? Jill of all trades, lover, mother, housewife, friend, breadwinner, heart and spade, a woman is a ritual, a house that must accommodate, a house that must endure generation after generation of wind and torment, of fire and rain. A house with echoing rooms, closets with hidden cries, walls with stretch marks, windows with eyes. Short, tall, skinny, fat, pregnant, married, white, yellow, black, brown, red, professional, working class, aristocrat, women cooking over coals in sampans, women shining Tiffany spoons in glass houses, women stretching their arms way above the clouds in Samarkand, in San Francisco, along the Mekong. That's who we are, and I'm glad of it. This problem enters every area. I think it's not just at work, although it's noticeably at work, but it's in our relationships a lot. We're controlled in our relationships, or we're controlling. We're not the best we can be. It's in our parenting and in our friendships and in our love lives. It comes into everything, and so it's really crippling if we don't try to get rid of it, I think. When I was looking through for some poetry, I was thinking about three levels of this problem. Images of ourselves that we've internalized, images of that are given to us by specific other people or places even. You go into your ancestral home and you become a different person than you are in your present home. Or the societal ones about women. And I was struck by the absence of poetry and short stories in the first category. And I thought, now that's odd, because that's the who we really are, that's the nitty-gritty. But then I realized that those are so painful, and that those are so disabling, when we have internalized these poor images of ourselves in particular, that we can't write about them because we hate ourselves too much. We hate ourselves so much when we think we're poor at something, when we think we're a poor mother. I can remember when my children were very small and I was exhausted. I would have days where I thought I was a terrible mother. Why should I write poetry about myself then? Or if I did a poor job at work, I don't want to talk about that. I don't want to think about it. So I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was, at the absence of content in the first category. I found one poem that sort of applies that I'd like to read to you. And it's a cross between the first and second of the categories. It's called Barbie Doll, by a woman called Marge Piercy. It's short. This girl child was born as usual and presented dolls that did pee-pee and miniature GE stoves and irons and wee lipsticks the color of cherry candy.
Then, in the magic of puberty, a classmate said, "You have a great big nose and fat legs." She was healthy, tested intelligent, possessed strong arms and back, abundant sexual drive and manual dexterity. She went to and fro, apologizing. Everyone saw a fat nose on thick legs. She was advised to play coy, exhorted to come on hearty, exercise, diet, smile, and wheedle. Her good nature wore out like a fan belt. So she cut off her nose and her legs and offered them up. In the casket displayed on satin, she lay with the undertaker's cosmetics painted on, the turned-up putty nose, dressed in a pink and white nightie. "Doesn't she look pretty?" everyone said. Consummation at last. To every woman, a happy ending. Reminds me of the Whoopi Goldberg excerpt that we saw at the end of Cheryl Stewart's session this afternoon, which was Whoopi Goldberg talking about how much she wanted to be white, acting as a 7-year-old child. She had on a white jacket or shirt that she was pretending was long blonde hair. And it was so funny, because Whoopi Goldberg has got the gift of humor, but it was so depressing and sad, and it really was awful in the end. You just wanted her to stop, because it was so upsetting. And Barbie doll is sort of that way, too. And see how they did turn between the two, because she started out feeling fine about herself, and then became what she had been told she was at puberty, a big nose and fat legs, so that she lost the original vision, and then she became that because that was the feedback she got.
I think you could substitute drugs in there for cutting off your nose and cutting off your arms, and it would be more realistic but still have the same impact. In other words, women do turn to other things to make themselves acceptable to society.
Mm-hmm. And make themselves feel better.
They do. Drugs and alcohol or whatever it takes. So I just have one more example of that I want to briefly tell you. When my children go to a school, a private school in Chicago, very wealthy people, and I always feel intimidated by those people because we're not wealthy. And I go and I see all their beautiful clothes and all this, the parents are real involved, and I always feel kind of, you know, less than adequate. And then I got a call this spring from somebody that I respect very much at that school asking me to run for the Board of Trustees, which is a very prestigious spot. And I was so full of myself. I felt so wonderful that someone had done that, had thought well enough of me that they would ask me to run for the Board of Trustees. The next day when I walked on campus, I'm sure I walked standing up straighter, and I felt so generous and strong and like I could solve problems and take on the world. It was a great feeling. And that's the kind of thing, you know. It's amazing, the difference. Why? It's one phone call, you know, but there it was. So that image can really get us. Alice Walker has a poem that's sort of a cross between the first and second positions there, too. And I'm just going to read you a little bit of it. "Forgive me if my praises," it's called. "Forgive me if my praises do not come easily. I do not praise myself. I am the cause of," he says, "my father's failure. Protecting me turned him into a coward. I, who curbed his temper and shaped his life. Me, who can now not praise my work." And she goes on talking about what in her coming up stopped her from feeling strong and good about herself. Finally, she says, "What I need, I know, is a good, satisfying love. With even one such as you, an open, seed-sowing hands on long arms embracing me with lips purple as tea cakes, kisses warm, a shoulder firm as the smooth, strong flanks of trees, to fight with me against my evil dreams."
So she recognizes that the right person can really make a difference in her life in terms of her accepting her own wonderful work. So then I moved on to the second category. There's lots of stuff that women have written about how they've been influenced by specific persons and places, and of course that did that some in that poem. So I'm going to use another Alice Walker to show you about that some. This one's very short and quite funny, I think. It's called Janie Crawford. I love the way Janie Crawford left her husbands. The one who wanted to change her into a mule, and the other who tried to interest her in being a queen. A woman, unless she submits, is neither a mule nor a queen, though like a mule she may suffer, and like a queen pace the floor. So that Janie Crawford would have none of it in either case, you know, whatever that man wanted. There's another one, which is a part of a short story, but I'm going to tell you about the story and then read you the couple of paragraphs at the end. It's Willa Cather's A Wagner Matinee, and it's about a farm woman from South Dakota who had been a music student in college and a good piano player out east for during her high school and college years. She was really a blossoming musician. And then after college, fell in love with a man who wanted her to come out to the prairie and homestead. And she homesteaded in a place that was started out with no home, and then a home on the dirt floor, and they raised turkeys, among other things, and her life was very hard. But during her early years at the homestead, she had a nephew whom she taught piano to. And he was her mainstay during those years because he was a talented boy. And then he left home and went off to the big city. And the story of Wagner Matinee is about this woman who had, for other reasons, I think legal reasons, to do something with a will or something, had to go to the big city for the first time in all these years, go back. And he takes her to a matinee, an afternoon performance of some Wagner music. And what I'm going to read to you is, it's all from the nephew's point of view, who's a grown man now, of course, in his 40s, I would say. And he's going to tell us her reaction to the music. He's probably maybe in his 50s, because I think she'd been out there for 50 years or so. Soon after the tenor began the prize song, I heard a quick-drawn breath and turned to my aunt. Her eyes were closed, but the tears were glistening on her cheeks, and I think, in a moment more, they were in my eyes as well. It never really died then, the soul which can suffer so excruciatingly and so interminably. It withers to the outward eye only, like that strange moss which can lie on a dusty shelf half a century and yet, if placed in water, grows green again. She wept so throughout the development and elaboration of the melody. A couple of paragraphs, and then the second half of the program consisted of four numbers from The Ring and closed with Siegfried's funeral march. My aunt wept quietly, but almost continuously, as a shallow vessel overflows in a rainstorm. From time to time, her dim eyes looked up at the lights, burning softly under their dull glass globes. The deluge of sound poured on. I never knew what she found in the shining current of it. I never knew how far it bore her or past what happy islands. From the trembling of her face, I could well believe that before the last number, she had been carried out where the myriad graves are, into the gray, nameless burying ground of the sea, or into some world of death vaster yet, where, from the beginning of the world, hope is lain down with hope, and dream with dream, and renouncing, slept. So she wasn't happy. She was suffering greatly through this being bathed in this beautiful sound. The concert was over. The people filed out of the hall, chattering and laughing, glad to relax and find the living level again. But my kinswoman made no effort to rise. The harpist slipped the green felt cover over his instrument. The flute players shook the water from their mouthpieces. The men of the orchestra went out one by one, leaving the stage to the chairs and the music stands, empty as a winter cornfield. I spoke to my aunt. She burst into tears and sobbed pleadingly, "I don't want to go, Clark. I don't want to go." I understood. For her, just outside the concert hall, lay the black pond with the cattle-tracked bluffs, the tall, unpainted house, the weather-curled boards, naked as a tower, the crook-backed ash seedlings where the dishcloths hung to dry, the gaunt, molting turkeys picking up refuse around the kitchen door. So that's the world she was going back to, she had been affected by play so profoundly, I think, by having her music cut off when she went there. And then remembering the pain of her, the pain of just remembering what it was like, what it could have been like, what was there for her. But after 50 years, Willa Cather talks about it as a shallow vessel. Her tears spilled out of a shallow vessel because she hadn't had the years of growth and depth and learning and becoming in her field. And so she obviously had other good things and gifts about her life, but the pain of that final image, the molting turkeys picking refuse around the kitchen door, oh my. I think that communicates pretty heavily what that environment has done to that woman. Someone else would have thrived on it, but she didn't. Then I want to illustrate the third point a little bit. The images of that society assigns to women. I'm going to read part of a poem called The Tired Poem. Last letter, and I think it's interesting, she says last letter, from a typical unemployed black professional woman. The poet is Donna Kate Russian. It's quite a long poem, and I'm just going to read you the first part of it. But I recommend it to you, and I'd be glad to loan it to you. So, it's a gorgeous afternoon in the park. It's so nice to forget your attitude. Attitude is with a capital letter. The one your mama taught you. The one that says, "Don't mess with me." You forget until you hear all this whistling and lip smacking. You whip around and say, "I ain't no damn dog." Professional woman speaking, and she does that because she needs to communicate in a hurry. She doesn't want the lip smacking and whistling around her, so she does what she knows will work. "I ain't no damn dog." It's a young guy. His mouth drops open. "Excuse me, sister." "How you doing?" You lie and smile and say, "I'm doing good. Everything's cool, brother." So she defused it, completely managed and defused that little interaction of somebody coming on to her and her man pushing him off and then making a little friendly encounter. "How you doing?" "I'm doing good. Everything's cool, brother." Then 5 minutes later, "Hey you, sweet devil. Hey girl, come here." You tense, sigh, calculate. You know the lean boys and bearded men are only cousins and lovers and friends. Sometimes when you say, "Hey," you get a beautiful surprised smile or a good talk. So she's saying, these are not the enemy, these are not alien people, these are regular people, but they're just behaving toward women the way they think they should. I'm going to stop the poem there, although it goes on a long time and it's a wonderful poem about being an unemployed black professional woman. And I'm going to tell you a little story. I teach in a place where my college students and I had to walk past construction every day for a semester. And a number of my women students and I, it was in the days when I was young and slim and blonde and pretty, we would all get the same thing, the catcalls and the whistling and the sort of constant attention, unwanted attention from the construction workers in that place. So one day I stopped and looked at them all and said, "Do you really think that I want to go to bed with you? What is there about me that makes you think I want to go to bed with you? Is it the way I'm dressed? Is it something about the way I look? Do you think you know me? Did we go to high school together? What is the story? Why are you doing this to us? Why are you doing it to my students? What?" And they just hemmed and hawed and sort of shuffle, they drew, you know, in the sand with their toes. And they weren't the enemy. They weren't the bad. They just, society has said, men do this to women. So they were doing this to women. And it was a real bad dynamic. It wasn't healthy for any of us. So finally we put a stop to it that day, and for the rest of the semester, whenever our class would start in the morning, these guys would all be digging away and working. I think it's the same thing that Donna Kate Russian is writing about here. It isn't that they're so bad, it's just that that societal thing is going on that we hate. We don't like it, and we want to call a halt to it. And calling a halt to it by looking it right in the eye was one way, but there are many ways to do it. So then the question is, what do you do, and how do you handle that? Maybe I could stop there for a minute and see if there are some reactions or things that people would like to throw in now.
It just triggers a wonderful story for me. We have a good friend who lived on a out in the country and in the woods kind of thing, and there was only one house right next to hers, her family's, and so there were some construction guys were up on the house next door, and same thing that happened with you. For several days it went on and on, cat calls and suggestive remarks and all that, and finally she took, there were a bunch of raccoons out, so she took her shotgun out and shot a raccoon that was about 10 feet from
her. Oh my.
And they shut up.
Right. Right. Well, you can really pose an alternate image. Sometimes when I have to work, go to meetings at night a lot, and when I'm coming home and I feel like I'm in some kind of danger, I just pose for myself a point of view. I take on the persona of a waitress who has worked two shifts, and I'm going home to six squalling children, and my house is dirty, and they're going to be hungry, and I'm tired, and I get so mad, and I work myself into such a state with this person that I become, that nobody would want to come anywhere near me for any reason, because I'm so unpleasant. My children aren't going to want to come near me. And so I really get into a storm home, and I'm just furious and tired, and if anybody came near me, they would regret it. And then I get in the house, and I have to quickly take off this person that I've become and try to get back to being a regular, not angry, not upset, not tired person. But I think that that kind of frame of mind can communicate, too. I think that's one little trick that you can use to help. Somehow we have to reclaim our images. We have to get to a place where we can recognize how powerful the imagery is that is negative around us, and then replace those things with positive images. And the literature is full of those, you'll be glad to hear. There's no problem with finding images of women in poetry and short stories who have overcome this kind of a thing, and I will read you some of those. I would like to suggest that conscious support is a good thing to do. If you're going into a meeting that you know is going to be problematic in this way, if you line up a couple of friends to say supportive things and to be supportive and to sit right where you can see them in front and to give you positive feedback, that really helps a lot. And the women's movement was good in that way. The women's movement taught women to support each other and to come through for each other. There are just little things you can do like that that help. In this book called Homegirls, a Black Feminist Anthology, there's a poem I'd like to read you called I Used to Think by Shirlane McRae. She says, I used to think I can't be a poet because a poem is being everything you can be in one moment, speaking with lightning protest, unveiling a fiery intellect, or letting the words drift feathers soft into the ears of strangers who will suddenly understand my beautiful and tortured soul. But I've spent my life as a black girl, a nappy-headed, no-haired, fat-lipped, big-bottomed black girl, and the poem will surely come out wrong, like me. And I don't want everyone looking at me. In the next section, she goes on and uses the word nigger a couple of times, which I am very
uncomfortable using and don't like to use, but I will use it because she said it. But I apologize. If I could be a cream-colored lovely with gypsy curls, someone's pecan dream and sweet sensation, I'd be poetry in motion, without saying a word. It wouldn't have to make, and I wouldn't have to make sense if I did. If I were beautiful, I could be angry and cute instead of an evil, pouting, mammy bitch, a nigger woman, passed over, conquested, and passing over a nigger woman to do it to in the bushes. She's communicating the image of someone that can be cheapened totally or enriched totally. And what we're all taught, women are taught, is that if we're cute or beautiful, we don't have to be smart and we don't have to be together. And that's what she says. And so she doesn't view herself as being beautiful. And so she says, therefore, I can be totally undermined and cheapened and thrown away. And all of us, I think, have those feelings. On stripping bark from myself, for Jane, who said trees die from it. So it's a poem about the death of a tree from stripping bark off of it, or the death of this person. Because women are expected to keep silent about their close escapes, I will not keep silent. And if I am destroyed, naked tree, someone will please mark the spot where I fall and know I could not live silent in my own lies, hearing there how nice she is, whose adoration of the retouched image I so despise. No, I am finished with living for what my mother believes, for what my brother and father defend, for what my lover elevates, for what my sister, blushing, denies or rushes to embrace. I find my own small person, a standing self against the world, an equality of wills I finally understand. Besides, my struggle was always against an inner darkness. I carry within myself the only known keys to my death, to unlock life or close it shut forever. A woman who loves wood grains, the color yellow and the sun, I am happy to fight all outside murderers as I see and must. So there, she has clearly said the outside negative things are the murderers, but that I have fought the battle with myself and won. And so I'll take on all comers because I'm a strong person. I've acknowledged, affirmed who I am as a person. A woman who loves wood grains, the color yellow and the sun. So she's come through that. Did somebody want to say something? Did I hear a response? You may say something if you'd like. So that's On Stripping Bark from Myself by Alice Walker. Another Alice Walker is Light Baggage. This is one solution, one possible solution to the kind of problem we were talking about, which is a solution that she talks about three different women, Zora Neale Hurston, Nella Larsen, and Jean Toomer, who wrote and published their best work during their 20s and 30s. At some point in their careers, each of them left the career of writing and went off seeking writing's very heart, life itself. Zora went back to her native Florida, where she lived in a one-room cabin and raised her own food. Jean Toomer became a Quaker and a country philosopher in Bucks County, Pennsylvania. And Nella Larsen, less well-known than either Hurston or Toomer, became a nurse. So this is a poem about these three women dealing with their image in society and who they are and how it affects what they become or with how they continue being. Called Light Baggage for Zora, Nella, and Jean. There is a magic lingering after people to whom success is merely personal, who, when the public prepares a feast for their belated acceptance parties, pack it up like light baggage and disappear into the swamps of Florida, or go looking for newer gods in the oak tree country of Pennsylvania, or decide quite suddenly to try nursing, midwifery, anonymous among the sick and the poor. Stories about such people tell us little, and if 100 photographs survive, each one will show a different face. Someone out of step, alone out there, absorbed, fishing in the waters of experience, a slouched back against the shoulders of the world. Those women didn't find that they needed what I would need, I think, which is a real rootedness in community and people who know me and people who trust me and love for my family. They may have had some of that, but the point of this poem is that they were so self-confident, they were so comfortable with themselves, that they didn't need the fame that they got and the image of the society around them. They were free to say, I'm ready to do something different now, and go off to a place where they weren't known and weren't famous, and they could just do something different. And they were still comfortable with themselves. I'm going to read you one more poem, and then we're going to talk. I'm going to hurry. If I can find it. Yeah, there it is. This one is called I Like to Think of Harriet Tubman by Susan Griffin. I like to think of Harriet Tubman, who carried a revolver, who had a scar on her head from a rock thrown by a slave master because she talked back, and who had a ransom on her head of thousands of dollars, and who was never caught, and who had no use for the law when the law was wrong, who defied the law. I like to think of her. I like to think of her especially when I think of the problem of feeding children. The legal answer to the problem of feeding children is 10 free lunches every month, being equal in the child's real life to eating lunch every other day, Monday, but not Tuesday. I like to think of the president eating lunch Monday, but not Tuesday. And when I think of the president and the law and the problem of feeding children, I like to think of Harriet Tubman and her revolver. And then sometimes I think of the president and other men, men who practice the law, who revere the law, who make the law, who enforce the law, who live behind and operate through and feed themselves at the expense of starving children because of the law. Men who sit in paneled offices and think about vacations and tell women whose care it is to feed children not to be hysterical. Not to be hysterical, as in the word hysterikos, the Greek for womb suffering. Not to suffer in their wombs. Not to care. Not to bother the men because they want to think of other things and do not want to take the women seriously. I want them to take women seriously. I want them to think about Harriet Tubman and remember she was beat by a white man and she lived. And she lived to redress her grievances, and she lived in swamps and wore the clothes of a man, bringing hundreds of fugitives from slavery and was never caught and led an army and won a battle and defied the laws. Because the laws were wrong. I want men to take us seriously. I am tired wanting them to think about right and wrong. I want them to fear. I want them to feel fear now, as I have felt suffering in the womb. And I want them to know that there is always a time. There's always a time to make right what is wrong. There's always a time for retribution. And that time is beginning. Woo. So there's lots of kind of triumphalist, strengthening, strong, supportive stuff that's been written. I mean, these books are full of it. How about in your lives? Does this apply to your lives? Is this true of your lives? Do you find yourself reflected in any of these images? Are these images that you can understand and relate to, or is the poetry helpful in terms of that?
There is a subculture as to what is beautiful in blackness as what is beautiful in whiteness. And if you were a quadroon, or if you were mixed with other races and had a lighter shade, or if you were a mulatto, which is a black and white combination, that was still seen as beautiful. And you could have heard a black man remark that I have never seen another white woman. That was made. Those kinds of statements were made. And that I have seen my women. But it was a different look. And this was in a particular era I'm talking about earlier. years. I'm not talking about the contemporariness of where whiteness and blackness are. But we've had to come through a different system as to looking at blackness through being nigger, being colored, being a Negro, being black. I mean, we've got all these connotations as to what it is that we're supposed to look like.
Mm-hmm.
So what mirror are we really looking into?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a mirror of whiteness? Is it a mirror of blackness? Or is it just a mirror of our own image and self-esteem?
Which is what I think these women argued.
Well, our culture worships beauty, and they're giving black women images too of what's beautiful. In fact, in some cases, I think they show very dark black women, don't they? And obviously very tall and thin, their clothes beautifully. And so we all can get the win. You know, it's whether you're Oriental, you're black, you're white. So there's those images of it.
So and none of us can look good enough for the models. I mean, none of us look like what we see on TV and what we see in the models in the magazines.
Do bronze really have more fun? I've never believed that. I love the fun, I've never bronze.
Well, we're taught certainly by our church things about beauty being more than skin deep. You know, that our real beauty comes from other sources. It's real hard to maintain that feeling in the face of all the pressure on us to try to look a certain way and be a certain way. And you know, what a difficult burden that is because none of us will ever look right. And the standards in the black community are along a different set of questions. In many of the poems that I've read here and didn't use here, I've noticed many, many references to being different colors, lighter to darker, and many wonderful adjectives talking about color. And white folks often just don't talk about color unless you got a tan. You've either got a tan or you don't. Or maybe rosy cheeks. So that's a different spectrum of questions of appearance. But we know what the marks of beauty are in our society. Somebody who hasn't spoken yet? Anybody? Okay, then someone who has, you too.
It seems I'm wondering how everyone sees the 80s in terms of these sorts of issues. I guess my bias is that we were making progress and now I'm under. It seems as if we've gone back in many ways to very rigid images of women, even though it's now perfect. Now you have to be successful on top of all the other images you had to be. It's like one more demand and expectation.
From women I know, being successful, being single and successful is a handicap. I have a very good friend who is high up in the Dayton Hudson Corporation, from Minnesota, for example. Is in, you know, her job is being above many men. And she has had trouble with guys not wanting to get close to her as a person because she ranks higher than they do. It's been very difficult. She's a lovely person. And she feels that is a common thing for women who have succeeded in areas other than teaching and nursing.
Another whole area, of course, with this is a terribly important set of ideas to think about is with inclusive language in the church. What are the images of women that the church has given us over the years? White, male. You know, when I was a kid, I couldn't light the candles or go up on the altar at all and do anything. Girls coming up in the church had to be out of sight and out of mind. They didn't do anything in the church. So the imagery that we're given is so dominant, predominantly one way. And when I hear all exclusive male language, both God language and people language, presented, which I do every Sunday in my church in Chicago, I feel excluded. I feel cut out. I feel like I'm not part of that. And I feel like my daughter feels that. And I don't think it's a healthy image for us to have and to grow up with and live with. And I don't think it's biblical. I mean, anybody who's had a child of either sex knows that you want that child to flower and grow and become fully what their talents enable them to do, not to stop and be held down and cut off because of their race or because of their sex or because it's inappropriate for girls to do one thing or inappropriate for anybody to do anything. You want that child to grow and flower fully, and that's what we want for ourselves. But these kinds of images in society that put ceilings and doors and limitations on people, I think are things that, I mean, God said we should develop our talents, right? It's whatever talents you're given, you're supposed to use and develop and not go and bury in the ground. So I think it's a poor thing to do with gifts and resources. Susan?
I was just thinking of a responsibility I think we all have in terms of images. We talk about our own self-image, but I think we're really responsible for holding up mirrors to each other. And I know how hard it is to hear certain things. I mean, somebody tried to tell me once they thought I was attractive. And I thought, my response was, I thought this was real good for me at that time. I said, well, I know I can be. And this person said, you didn't hear me. I'm saying something different. And, you know, my ears were just, it was a real shock. It still shocked me today to think that I filter so much of what I hear from other people, and it comes out something totally different than maybe they said because of my own self-image. And somehow I think I remembered that sort of as a pattern when I talk to people, sometimes checking out to make sure they really heard what I was saying. And when you think of identifying gifts, you know, part of the reason I became a pastor is because other people identified those gifts long before I ever did, let alone heard them. I mean, they were identifying before I was hearing. I filtered that out too. But there's something about helping each other to mm-hmm. see ourselves again, and not to assume because we said it, somebody heard it. Mm-hmm. But also just to build each other, building up the community is part of what that is. And those things have meant a lot to me in more ways than I realized even at the time, in terms of my own image. But I think we can all do that in a lot of ways.
Clear, supportive, positive feedback. That's so important to do for women, to do for each other. I think, you know, that's something you ought to consciously work at and develop. I certainly do. I have a women's group that's met every other Wednesday night for 16 years. And we give each other clear, supportive feedback. And we talk about our lives and we, you know, we help each other through rough times. But just to make us get rid of some of the parts of our socialization that we don't like, things that we believe about ourselves that we don't want to believe. Well, thank you all very much. It's time for Vespers.